Carl Azus. Welcome to CNN 10 on this December 6th. Our show starts in southeastern Asia, in an archipelago located between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. This is what happened on Saturday on the Indonesian island of Java. Mount Semeru is the tallest mountain on the island, and its eruption has left entire villages covered with ash, hundreds of homes destroyed, and more than 1,000 people without a place to live. Mount Semeru is located on the eastern part of Java, about 430 miles from Indonesia's capital, Jakarta. Officials say they started getting reports of falling ash and the smell of sulfur at about 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and footage from the government's emergency response team showed people running and taking shelter as huge clouds of ash descended around them. At least 14 people were killed in the eruption. 9 are still missing, dozens were injured, and officials say the mountain is still dangerous because it's produced at least 2 pyroclastic flows. These are mixtures of rock, ash, and volcanic gases, and they're extremely hot and impossible to predict. They're also more dangerous than lava. People living as far as 6 miles away from Mount Semeru have been told to evacuate. They've taken shelter in schools, other public buildings, and mosques, and emergency response teams have been unable to reach some villages because they've been cut off by mud and fallen trees. They're asking for equipment and manpower to support rescue efforts. The Indonesian government is preparing to relocate those who've lost their homes. Experts say eruptions like this are common in Indonesia. It's located in an area of high tectonic and volcanic activity known as the Pacific Ring of Fire.
There's one thing you need to know about the Ring of Fire. It produces 90% of the world's earthquakes. The Ring of Fire includes about 450 volcanoes. Many of them are submarine volcanoes, meaning they're underwater, as are 75% of the world's volcanoes in total. Now, the Ring of Fire is also called the Circum-Pacific Belt. It's the result of plate tectonics. The movement of the plates has created a nearly continuous series of oceanic trenches and chains of volcanoes stretching for 25,000 miles in a horseshoe-shaped pattern from New Zealand past Japan across the Bering Strait and down toward the tip of South America. The plate movement also causes earthquakes. Because many of these earthquakes occur in the ocean, the Ring of Fire is also known for tsunamis, produced when the ocean floor is either forced to rise or fall. When a megathrust event happens in this region, the water is displaced and the water pushes ashore. Most tsunamis are only a few inches high, but there are times that that wave and that swell can be as tall as buildings.
Starting Monday, most people planning to fly to the U.S. are facing a new COVID restriction. They need to show proof of a negative test taken within 1 day of their departure to America. Until now, that test could have been taken within 3 days of their flight. The new rules in place, regardless of whether travelers have gotten a COVID vaccine, those who can prove they've recovered from coronavirus within the past 90 days won't have to take the test, neither will children under age 2. This is part of an effort by the Biden administration to slow the spread of Omicron, a newly identified mutation or strain of COVID. It's not known yet how dangerous it is, how easily it spreads, or whether vaccines are effective against it. But President Joe Biden says the rules are intended to give people more time to get vaccinated. His administration's also extended a requirement that travelers on planes, trains, and buses wear masks, and it's put a ban on travel from 8 countries in southern Africa where Omicron was first identified. The ban doesn't apply to U.S. citizens. Critics say travel bans aren't very effective against the spread of COVID, but that they could make other countries hesitant to report new mutations of it if they're afraid they'll be, quote, punished by travel bans. Research on COVID mutations varies from country to country.
In the past few months, the Philippines has seen record COVID case numbers. And as officials try to contain the virus on the streets, inside this lab in Davao City, they're fighting on a different front.
The first rule in war is that you have to know your enemy. And for us to know our enemy in this pandemic, we have to sequence it.
In the battle against COVID, the lab has the artillery it needs to sequence the virus, this tiny machine. The problem is that it can barely afford the ammunition, the chemicals to actually make it work. They cost about $900 for just a couple hundred test samples. In a given month, they say thousands are needed to fully track the virus.
Recently, we started a crowdfunding campaign, and so far we raised around 400 euros. You know, in the Philippines as well, you know, $1,000 is like two people's monthly salary. So it's not insignificant here.
That relatively small funding gap is a big reason why developing countries are lagging so far behind in identifying COVID-19 variants that might be more deadly or more transmissible. In the West, labs like the UK's Sanger Institute are sequencing the virus on a huge scale, using multi-million dollar machines like these. According to GISAID, the global COVID variant database, the biggest contributions are coming from the richest countries. Some countries haven't sequenced any genomes at all, which means none of us know which variants are circulating there, ready to potentially spread across borders.
If we don't get to do sequencing in many parts of the world, then definitely we're missing out on possible variants that are, you know, emerging.
We know how rapidly new variants can take hold. The Delta variant first emerged in India in April and was the dominant variant worldwide by mid-July. Omicron, the new variant first spotted in South Africa, was declared a variant of concern in record time and is predicted by some experts to become the dominant strain in the days ahead. Its emergence highlighting again the importance of real-time virus surveillance. Getting the necessary technology out to all corners of the globe is part of the challenge. And this company, an hour north of London, thinks they have an answer.
The technology to sequence the virus in remote labs around the world is being manufactured here on an industrial scale. It's small and relatively inexpensive. The challenge has been getting governments to actually use it.
10-second trivia. The U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division was activated during what war? World War I, World War II, Korean War, or Vietnam War? The 101st was activated in 1942 while the U.S. was engaged in World War II. At the time, the division's first commanding general said, though it had no history, the 101st had a rendezvous with destiny, and the paratroopers have served in every corner of the world since then. A specific group of men in this division became known as the Band of Brothers, first in a best-selling book by historian Stephen E. Ambrose, and later in an HBO miniseries. They were the soldiers of Easy Company, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. And the last surviving officer from the Band of Brothers passed away on Friday at the age of 99. His name is Colonel Edward Shames. He was part of the first combat jump into Normandy, France on D-Day. His obituary says he was the first member of his division to enter the Dachau concentration camp after it was liberated in 1945. He was also among those who entered Hitler's eagle's nest in Germany as the war was ending. Colonel Shames was remembered as a, quote, stubborn and outspoken soldier who had the highest standards for himself and the men he served with. Here's one of his reflections from an interview he gave in 2014.
There's two things that I'm proud of that I did in World War II. Number one was my battlefield commission, and the other was that I brought more men home from my platoon than any other of the 200 platoons in the 101st Airborne Division. The rest is what I was supposed to do and how I was supposed to do it.
For some of us, it's hard enough to solve a Rubik's Cube, like, period. But if it comes easy, naturally, and quickly to you, check out what it takes to be a semi-finalist in a fastest hand competition when you gotta solve a Rubik's Cube like this. Juliette Sebastien from France, who provided this video, holds a couple European records for getting the colors all lined up. She says she's practiced with a cube in her pocket while walking around. You could call her a true artist. A cubist. Kinda like Rubens, except Rubik's. I guess to be successful, you gotta block everything else out, keep your head from spinning while your hand does, make it your transmission to be monochrome automatic, and build your record brick by brick by taking it 3x3 steps at a time. Olympia High School, we see you watching from Olympia, Washington. Thank you for your request on our YouTube channel. I'm Carl Azus, and that's CNN.